Hello, my friends. This week, I want to address something a little more serious before we get into the podcast. Over the last month, the news in the world has been so very heartbreaking and heavy, and it has been difficult to watch the news, let alone engage with it. And I'm always torn between being informed and protecting my own heart. That being said, I'm also torn about whether this podcast is appropriate at these times of great suffering and great misery and great sorrow for the world. I am aware that I'm operating in a space where I suggest that there's great hope, that everyone should be optimistic about the universe and about the energies that work in this universe, and that therefore our ultimate good, all of us, each and every one of us, the ultimate good for all of us. And so it is really hard, really challenging to put this podcast out when that is obviously what's not happening all over the world. And so often I'm torn between putting out a podcast that suggests that there are reasons for hope, that there are reasons to believe in a greater good out there. But when faced with what's happened in Maine, and then of course in the Middle East, it's really challenging to even entertain the thought that the great energy that enlivens this universe, this creation, is really operating for the good of everyone. So please know that I'm wrestling with that, and that this podcast is not put out there in this thoughtless way. That even I am wrestling with what it looks like to be optimistic in a world where there is so much suffering and so much grief and loss. I still want to suggest that there's reason for hope, that there's reason to believe in others, that there's reason to believe in a world that is good for everyone. But my heart is heavy too, and I am heartbroken as well. So with that introductory statement, I'm going to go into the podcast this week. It's a guest I've had on before, Holly, such a dear one, such a dear friend. And she lived in New Orleans for a while, in a couple of houses, but I'm sure as you suspect, houses in New Orleans come with more than just four walls and a floor. Sometimes these houses in New Orleans, well, they come with a few extra roommates, as you'll hear as Holly tells her tales.
As you know, my husband and I, we are from New Orleans. We lived in New Orleans the majority of our adult lives. So we were adults there. We moved there in 2004 when Will was 9 months old. And lived there until Will's ballet career took off. And that's really what had us leave. We lived in there. We lived in for 9 years. And I'm going to tell you some stories about that house. To understand kind of the context, and I think of New Orleans and the spirits that inhabit the city and the spaces, you have to understand the architecture just a little bit. So we moved in 2004 to a shotgun double. And this was a home near the river. So in this part of Uptown, these homes were built from barge boards from the Mississippi River. So barges would come down to deliver goods and in New Orleans. And as they took apart and used everything, literally the boards from the boats became the parts of these homes. And the way that homes were taxed was on frontage and on stories. So shotgun homes were the cheapest things to build. So shotgun homes mean that they are literally room to room to room. You could open the front door and the back door and fire a shotgun and it would go straight through the house, which is why it's a shotgun home. A double shotgun means that the owners couldn't afford four separate walls, so they share an interior wall. So it would have been two homes together. And over time, it's in vogue to renovate these doubles into singles. So you take parts out of that middle wall and make it a single home. So we bought this house in, like I said, in 04. And as part of the foreclosure, the bank had stripped everything of value out of the house. So when we bought it, it had no kitchen, no working bathroom. It had a huge plumbing leak, which was termite infested, and that's how we bought it and how we moved in and lived with it with our 9-month-old. So we started sort of work on it very early with all that we had. And actually, just an interesting side note, the reason the home had fallen in foreclosure is in the mid-90s, there was a terrible accident. A cargo ship, I think it was called the Bright Lights, filled with grain, lost control of its motor and crashed into Riverwalk, which is a shopping area near the port of New Orleans, right on the river. And the owner of the home had had a shop in Riverwalk that was destroyed by this disaster. Yeah, like no, I don't think anyone died, but dozens of people were injured. It was this huge thing. Anyway, so the owner fell on hard times and then eventually would lose the home. And so that's how we got it and why it was sort of stripped of everything, et cetera. So we put all the rubbing our nickels together, got a kitchen together and got a working bathroom for the most part. And then we're doing, electric work. You know, the home still had electric wires in cloth. And there was a lot of those things to happen. We were doing this, ourselves with a toddler or baby. And Katrina happened. And after Katrina, we lived in the home with other families. And there was a lot going on. So all that to say, we would not have our renovations done to a point of livability for about 7 years in that home. And we lived there 9 years. So we had a circular saw in the living space of the house until the day the Saints won the Super Bowl. We hosted a Super Bowl party that day and moved the saw out. So we were in a constant construction zone in this home. And I think because of it, our neighbors sort of looked at us as we were like the plucky young couple. And so, people would be really supportive and come by with advice. And we would learn all these tidbits about the house over the years doing this work. So we live in this house, and one of the things that happened is right next door to the home was an empty lot. And shortly after we purchased our home, the owner of the lot began to build a home there. And they did it. You can get away with a lot in New Orleans sometimes, particularly post-Katrina. They built the home too high. So drainage was going under our home, which would have hurt the integrity and the stability of how sort of flat our home was. And so we needed to do, one of the first projects we had to do was to sort of, or after Katrina, was to sort of irrigate our home properly, which meant we had to dig up the side of the house and put in a French drain for everything to drain properly to the street. So as we started this work and started digging up, we came upon all these bricks, and they're like 1850s, 1840s. They're stamped. They're from like Ohio. Clearly they were on those barges, and they're all through the backyard of the house. And in talking to one of our neighbors, they said, oh yeah, there used to be an alley behind all of our homes. And those bricks are. So we dug up all these bricks, we cleaned them, and we used them to build this pathway along the house. And once we had everything sort of flat, we put an addition on the back. So the way that the homes were done in shotguns is you'd have sort of room, room, room. And then at the back, they would slap anything that needed utility. So your kitchens and bathrooms were kind of slapped onto the back. Ours in the back had these bathrooms. And so we built this addition without messing with the interior of the house first. Built the addition and then had to gut the bathroom section where we put a full bathroom and a laundry room. When I say that this was a 5 years of progress doing this work. So I found out I was pregnant with Kate, our daughter, the day we evacuated for Katrina. So all of this is going on through that time. So Kate is now a toddler in the time that we're sort of getting in this story. And she's talking. And I would say, within the first dozen words she starts to use regularly is the word Sam. And And we hear about Sam all the time. All of her friends know about Sam. Our friends, when she goes to play at other people's houses, she talks about Sam. She talks about Sam at school to the point where her teachers think that I'm pregnant with another child that we're going to call Sam. Sam is everywhere. She draws pictures of Sam. She can't go to sleep because Sam wants to play. It's like this thing. And all of us assume that she has an imaginary friend. And this goes on for a number of years as we're doing this construction. So she is probably 2.5 when we begin to gut that middle section, those bathroom areas of the back of the house. And as he's pulling up layers of floor, Paul finds fire damage, like old fire damage. And we find out from our neighbors that the reason there was a lot next door was that there was a cottage in the back of the lot that burned down. And one of our neighbors, we find out, has pulled the Sanborn maps, which are like, they're like maps of homes. They're just give you the kind of the footprint of where the house is. And in New Orleans, it's done every couple of years. And you can see, like, so we know that that particular home was built somewhere around 1900 because it's not on the Sanborn map in 1895, but it is in the Sanborn map in 1905. So we know this there. And there's a cottage on the Sanborn map then. It actually predated our house. And by 1920, that house is gone. So at some point in those years, the house is gone, and which is why there was a lot. So, which makes sense. And we, at the time, we were like, oh, well, of course, if there's a lot in New Orleans, it's not because the house was never there. It's because something happened to take it away. So we find out that there's a house. We find fire damage. And we put it together. It probably burned down. So somewhere in that timeline, Kate's conversations of Sam get a little more intense, where like we're having to go into Kate's room and tell Sam to leave her alone so she can go to sleep at night. We're having, like, in other words, like Sam is becoming, it's like a thing. And she starts telling us more stuff, like Sam died in a fire. Sam and his mom died in a fire. Sam looks like this. Sam, we're getting all of like the stuff about Sam. And around the same time, so Kate's, you know, 3-4, like a friend came and stayed with us and would stayed in Kate's room and came out the next morning. And he said, there was a boy ghost pulling at the covers in the middle of the night last night and I couldn't sleep. And we're like, what did he look like? And he's like, he had overalls. He was really like was very vivid, everything. And I pull one of Kate's pictures that she's drawn of Sam. And I'm like, babe, shit. She goes, and he, kid drawings, right? There's like all kind of people. He points right to the one where Kate had said, this is Sam. And it's like, actually, it's kind of like that. So around this same time, Paul would travel for work. And so one night, I'm there, the kids are there. I'm sleeping in bed, and the way that, you know, it was a double, right? So the bedrooms, or we had a hallway kind of in the middle, but bedrooms on either side. And Kate's room is in the back. You'd have to go through her house, her room rather, to get to the back of the house. So I'm in bed in my, I'm facing the hallway, laying in bed. My bed's against the back wall, and I'm reading. And over the book, so you're sort of in my sight of blur, where I can see over the book, I see a transparent man in a morning jacket and a hat, like a top hat, go by into Kate's room. He was transparent-ish, but it was as clear as day. And our cat, who was sleeping at my feet, hisses. And I have this moment where I'm frozen, but then I'm like, the parent part of me clicks in and I'm like, my daughter's room. So I ran into Kate's room. Kate's room is, you know, it's probably 25 degrees colder than the rest of the house. It's freezing. And this is New Orleans. It's not a winter month. And I get her out of bed and I bring her to my bed. I check on Will. And like that happened. So after that happened, and then after the sort of Sam sighting, then I start talking to my friends. So a friend who is, you know, a little more in touch with this stuff. So she comes and does like a sage thing and sort of does this thing. And she's like, yeah, you have several spirits in the house. And there's a little boy and he's trapped there by some kind of older thing, but there's actually several spirits in the house, and the majority of them are sort of, they're really happy, they're happy that what you're doing to the house, but there is this other thing, and this other thing is in Kate's room. And so what's interesting about this too is we had a chronic issue with termites only in Kate's room. And it was like the bane of our existence until the day we sold the house, that that we had just constant term just in the space, just in her room, which you know, is the thing. So people would say like, it's in Kate's room, it's in the space. So this was just like part of our like living house. The other sort of significant happening there. So I worked for the University of Liverpool and designed their Master of Public Health program, and which was a global program, and a lot of it is online. And those online components, like when you would log in for the online program, it's my voice telling you, like introducing you to the chapter, whatever. So I'm working and I'm home alone. There's no one there. Paul is traveling and I'm working, and I'm in the very front of the house, and the house is 80 feet long, maybe even a little more than that because we put that addition on. And when we put the addition on, we made like a family room and we made an office for Paul and I. But for whatever reason, I'm like by the kitchen, maybe I'm got something in the stove. So I'm like at the kitchen table and I'm recording. And all the way in the back, I can hear Paul coughing really loud and like stomping around, stomp, 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 cough, 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 stomp, stomp, stomp. And so, and I'm worried that it's coming up in the recording. So I'm stopping the recording. I'm yelling like, I'm recording, like, please stop. And I'm re-recording and it's happening again. And I kid you not, this is like four times of this. And finally I get up and I get a glass of water and I go in the back to bring all the way in the back of the house to bring the glass of water to Paul before I realize, oh, Paul's not here. He's out of town. And it was, I believe that that was the point that I started talking to the house. So I would have these conversations like, I understand that you're here and that's totally fine. I have to do this work. I need you to be quiet. And that became part of our living there. So when things would go wrong, we would have to have a conversation with like, you know, this would mean like, just like with Kate and like ghosts, like she needs to go to sleep. This was part of our daily lives. So it was just how we lived in this house. We would, after this house, have an opportunity. We did another, bought another trashed house and completely renovated it ourselves. And in that home was built by a man named William Delaney, who was a prominent plasterer. He was actually the president of the Plasterers Union in New Orleans and like did the plaster work in the Opera House and apparently grew orchids and saw all kind of newspaper articles that we found about him. He built this house in 1895, between 1895 and 1896. And the house, it has like 45 stained glass windows, and it's a really unique, beautiful house. Original plaster work from him was still on the room in the house. And there's a lot about this house that was really special. So when we bought it, there were old portraits in the attic. And I brought them to the local archivist to restore them. We actually picked them up 3 days before the art center, the restoration center, actually had a terrible fire and burned to the ground. So thankfully we got the portraits for them, and she was able to date them based on the frames and different aspects of them. And we were able through different, we actually worked with an archivist and through records, found out that the older one was his wife, Josephine, and their oldest daughter. And we hung these portraits in the front, and there were things that we did renovation in the house. And we actually, my friend, the spiritual person, came and told us that, yes, there were spirits there, but they were so excited that we were there. They knew that they were excited that a family was there. And the energy in this house was really amazing. But it had these quirks. And one of the quirks was there's a front parlor, and there were double doors, stained glass double doors that went to a deck, kind of an upper deck, like a porch. And the doors would not open. And I started talking to Josephine and asked permission. And it works. So in order to this day. So when we sold the house, we had a whole conversation when we were working with our realtors. We would say, you have to ask Josephine or you can't open the door. And the realtor called after and said, oh my gosh, you are right. I could not open the door until I asked for permission. I said, I know, you have to ask permission. Mr. Delaney actually died in that home. He got pneumonia and died in that home. And his bedroom was in where we put the kitchen, kind of in the second parlor area is where his bedroom was. And it was the center of the home and the heart of the home. People would comment about this. There was an energy in that space. And so it was part of the New Orleans style goes, yes, like this was his space. This is where his spirit left us. And we can feel it here. Which sounds out of there, but it was like, you'd be at a party and you'd be mixing a drink and then you talk about it, in the middle of those contexts, but it became part of those things. So Josephine and William were like extra family members that would get talked about within the context of this house regularly. So those are our ghost stories, our personal ghost stories from New Orleans. We still, as a family, talk about Sam. Kate doesn't have a whole lot of memory of it now, but we still talk about it. And I have somewhere in her old stuff, I have tons of drawings that she did. And she wrote stories about Sam. She talked about if Sam could come to Disney World with us. I mean, it was like a major part of our family still. But yeah, so those are my stories.
Right, my sweets, and this has been the next episode in our October Spookathon. There will be a link to a blog about Sam under the episode show notes, and then on the treasures page, I'm going to include a photo of that beautiful second house that they lived in where the portraits were discovered. Thank you to everyone who's been listening to our October month of ghosts and spooks and everything haunted. And when November begins, we will be back in the thick of things, of magical events, of miraculous events, of events that have changed people's lives. If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or writing a review wherever you listen. Those ratings and reviews are ever so helpful in helping others find us. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Holly. If your kid comes up and says, hey, I've got a new imaginary friend, and there's just like a little too much detail, there's a little too much attention to detail, and the stories keep getting more complicated and complex, and that imaginary friend starts to get a little too familiar, a little too, you know what I mean, lacking healthy boundaries, just say, what the hey, live with it. It's free childcare. And by the way, you never know what kind of friendship and community and belonging that your kiddo is bringing to that ghost. Halloween is next Tuesday, and I'm hoping to drop another episode on that day, but depending on life, we will see what happens. And until then, I hope that your world is filled with love, with laughter, and with maybe a few things that go bump in the night.
But it sounds like it happened over time, that kind of slowly Sam just kind of became assimilated into the family and wasn't threatening, just wanted to have someone to hang out with.
Yeah, it was really like a bell curve of experience, if that makes sense. Like there was like a really intense couple of years. And then I'd say our last 2 years there, so Kate would have been, over the age of five, we moved when she was seven, was when it really started to kind of taper out. My friends that sort of saw all of this would comment, yeah, like she, like literally she's growing out of it, was kind of the general idea. And when we ask Kate about it now, she'll be like, absolutely, Sam was a ghost. Like she's, You know, she embraces the sort of New Orleansness of this. Absolutely, he was my imaginary friend, but he was a ghost. He was a ghost, and that's what it is. So yeah, so our Sam ghost that lived with us for, you know, the better part of 5 or 6 years, I guess.
I love all of these stories because I think it's so interesting. I mean, like, Sam is a ghost of place, right? His house or cottage conceivably burned down, it sounds like, and he and his mother passed away in that, but he's kind of like there still, part of the tapestry of the area, of the history, you know. And you just have to be sensitive enough or young enough to kind of be able to, I don't know, delve into that history or witness that history in another way. That's such a, I love how you took it all in stride. I mean, I think for a while you're like, this is imaginary, like not a big deal. And then after a while you're like, okay, this is a little more than I thought it was, but we'll figure it out.
Yes, we were definitely, it was definitely like, there was a period of sort of discovery and kind of figuring out how to balance what life is in that space.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel if any, you know, if one of the many lessons New Orleans taught me is to exist in that space, you take what it gives you. So it is a space filled with energy and spirits and history. You embrace it. You ask to belong and hope that you're accepted. And I think that, I mean, maybe that's true for anything, but that certainly feel like something I learned in New Orleans. If you're there and you want to be there, you give yourself to it, you accept what's there and ask for acceptance into it. And that's kind of the way we approached it.